Good morning.
Morning.
Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. This morning, we, as always, welcome all of you into this space. Today, though, is a special day because we are setting aside time to acknowledge our receipt of a 450-year-old gift that all can share, no matter who you are, where you are on the journey of life, where your search is going as you seek to understand what it means to be human. You are welcome here, no matter what your ethnicity is, your faith tradition, whether you grew up churched or unchurched, whatever your gender is, your sexual preference, your abilities or non-abilities, we welcome you. If this is one of your first Sundays here, or you're back and haven't been here for a while, we urge you to come to more than one service because they can be very different. There will be time later on in the service when visitors and or newcomers may introduce themselves if they so desire. In the meantime, may you find some peace and understanding before you leave this space today. The opening words are written by a woman named Ann Pert. We come together to celebrate who we are, to share the insights that give meaning and hope to our lives, to learn from the wisdom of others that their truths may contribute to our understanding. We gather, we share, we learn, we celebrate our coming together. Mary, would you please, this Mary, light the chalice? Thank you. For centuries, people have told stories, celebrated life, and approached the ultimate while gathered around a fire. Today, we light this chalice that the heart fire of our hearts may be rekindled, that our stories may be retold, that we might celebrate life anew, and that we might approach that which is of ultimate value. A reading from An Introduction to the Unitarian and Universalist Traditions by Andrea Greenwood and Mark Harris. Once there were three men, not those three men, not the wise men. Just realized it's that time of year. Once there were three other men who were in the same book club and also of different faiths. Michael, George, and Francis, or Miguel, Giorgio, and Ferenz, had very different backgrounds, spoke different languages, practiced different professions. Like us, they lived in an era when technology completely changed how information spread. For us, it is the digital age and globalization. For them, half a millennium ago, it was the printing press and the establishment of transatlantic trade routes. Their book club, that is, was centered permanently on one book, the Bible. But because of the printing press, that book could be studied outside of monasteries and in several languages. People began to read the words themselves. The atmosphere for discussion grew much larger. It was everywhere. It was not necessary to actually attend religious services, you didn't hear me say that, to be heavily involved in the dialogue. Miguel Servetus, who trained as a lawyer and also worked as a cartographer, noticed that there was no Trinity in the Bible. And he wrote about this, advocating for Unitarian understandings of God. His books were banned, and I would add eventually burned. Originally from Aragon, Servetus had moved throughout Germany, Italy, and France, but when his religious ideas created trouble, he went to Geneva, where the Protestant Reformation was underway. This could have worked out for him. It didn't. Some of the reformers were open to discussion of Unitarianism, but Servetus also decided that he could not believe in predestination, so he managed to offend John Calvin, as well as the entire Catholic Church. Servetus's story ended in the same manner as that of many other independent thinkers in the 16th century, at the stake, in flames. Giorgio Biandrata landed in Geneva too, fleeing Italy because he had read the Bible carefully and he could not find any evidence of a Trinity there. He decided to leave the Catholic Church. Although most copies of Miguel Servetus' books had been destroyed, Biandrata managed to have one. A doctor, he traveled in high circles, eventually becoming the court physician in Poland. Poland at this time was one of the fourth largest country in what we now call Europe. Biandrata then ended up in Transylvania, where he found a sympathetic ear when he lent his copy of Servetus' book to a Hungarian Protestant minister, Francis David. And then Biandrata persuaded King John Sigismund to have David appointed court preacher. David read that book, talked with the doctor, and converted Sigismund, and both Unitarianism and freedom of conscience were born. So we have a doctor, a lawyer, a minister, and a king. One was born in Spain, one in Italy, another in Transylvania, and the fourth in Hungary. Servetus's book said, "Faith is with respect to God. Love is with respect to God and to our neighbor. Loving is made difficult, more difficult than believing. Love bears all difficulties, endures all things, renders easy all things, including poverty and death. Because love is more lasting, love is a natural symbol of the future kingdom. Faith begins, but love completes. For ideas like this, people were burned at the stake. We are so lucky, so fortunate. We people sitting in this room, long, long ago, way before we were born, much further back than most people can trace their ancestry, some very brave people gave us a gift. The gift of religious freedom. Stated another way, the gift of believing that humans are capable of cultivating an open mind that ponders the big questions in life, and that we are capable of doing this on our own terms, without fear, without terrifying repercussions, even without intermediaries, such as a pope or a bishop, or a prophet, or a minister, whether the prophet is named Jesus, or Muhammad, Isaiah, or Joshua, though others can certainly serve as our guides and mentors. If you read the information about today's service in the December issue of our newsletter, Prairie Fire, you will know that I want to transport you to the year 1568, just for a few minutes this morning. It is so very difficult, though, to put ourselves into another century, even another decade in this current century, or the last one. A few months ago, I think it was Memorial Day weekend, I mentioned Mitch Daniels, who teaches a class at Purdue on the history of World War I. If that name sounds vaguely familiar to you, he's an occasional columnist for the Washington Post. Mitch Daniels' method of teaching his World War I class is to give each student a flag of one of the countries that participated in World War I, and then the challenge to his students is to defend whatever their country did in that war. Daniels instructs them to try to put themselves into that time period as much as they can, which means being creative, imaginative, questioning, curious. That's the kind of mindset I'm aiming for this morning, because history really is fascinating and exciting. Some of you probably read that blurb about today's subject matter and unfortunately thought, oh no, not another history lesson, not again. Actually, I've not done anything about history for almost a year. It has been my intention, though, all during this fiscal or calendar year of 2018 to have a program about the Edict of Torda, which, of course, you're all very familiar with and have heard of. Yes, right. You probably know, too, that there were three Edicts of Torda from meetings in the city of Torda, yes, that were about freedom of thought. But the Edict of Torda, capitals across the board, the one that Unitarians consider to be the most important one, was that one issued in 1568. So, hence my wanting to do something in 2018, but suddenly running out of Sundays. This year is the 450th anniversary of the first ever proclamation of religious freedom, proclaimed by the only Unitarian king in history, King Sigismund. You can tell a story, that is, you can't tell a good story without entering into the realm of history. And this is a good story. I assure you that history well told is not one bit boring. I will also tell you something you might not know about me. Those of you who say that you don't like history, do not scare me one little bit, because I have been challenged by more history-resistant people than any of you could possibly be. I taught 7th and 8th grade history. Keep in mind that well-known saying about repeating our mistakes, personal mistakes, as well as those belonging to all of humanity. If we don't understand history or are ignorant of it, then we are bound to repeat the mistakes of the past. So I hope that you receive two takeaways from today's program. The first one is this: a sense of profound gratitude for all people, all those people, not only Unitarians and Universalists, but all those people who came before us and were courageous enough to question authority, to question why things are the way they are, to speak truth to power. And the second takeaway, I hope, will be some insights into why some people have the courage or the chutzpah or the audacity or whatever it is to speak with authenticity and integrity from the deepest parts of their being, from their souls, even though this speaking truth to power could result in their losing everything. On the flip side of that, why are there not more people who have that inclination? Perhaps they don't realize that this is a choice in life. In the November 26th issue of the New Yorker magazine, there's an article about Marie Cohen. Anybody know that name? She was a reporter for the London Sunday Times. Starting in the mid-1980s, she was deployed to conflict after conflict, I'm quoting from the New Yorker article now, in Beirut, Chechnya, East Timor, Kosovo. In Sri Lanka in 2001, she lost her left eye to grenade shrapnel, and thereafter she wore an eye patch. In Libya during the Arab Spring, she landed a critical interview with the deposed despot Muammar Gaddafi, and in 2012, she went to Syria. After she reported that Bashar al-Assad's forces were slaughtering civilians in the ravaged city of Homs? I've read it, I haven't obviously spoken the word much. But after she reported this, the media center where she was working was bombed, allegedly by the regime, which had discovered her location. Colvin died instantly at the age of 56. Well, I think you're going to hear a lot about her in the upcoming weeks, because there's been a movie made, and the title of the movie is A Private War. about this woman. The person who's playing her, a woman whose last name is Pike, became fascinated with Colvin, as you might imagine, and with why this woman was brave enough to do this. And she tried to retrace some of Marie Colvin's steps. And when she was giving the interview, this is the actress who plays Colvin, they passed an array of posters about the AIDS epidemic in Syria or in someplace in Africa, including one that said, "Silence equals death." And right before Marie Colvin left to go to Syria, where, as I said, she was killed, people were warning her about the level of danger there. And she said, "It's so anger-making, it's worth it. It's so anger-making, it's worth it." So back to the 1500s. Try to imagine a little bit what it might have been like to live then. As I alluded to earlier, one reason that I love history is that it demands that we tap into our creative selves and let imagination and curiosity rule. The 1500s, the 16th century. Well, no central heating. Wouldn't have to worry about being too warm up here. No electricity. No television. No radio. No cell phones. No social media. At least not the kind of social media we think of when we hear those words today. But there was something in the 1500s that earlier people did not have, and it was in the reading, the printing press. I don't like Wikipedia particularly, but sometimes they can condense things well. Wikipedia says that the printing press was invented around 1439, but by 1500, and remember we're mostly concentrating on the mid to late 1500s. So by 1500, printing presses in operation throughout Western Europe had already produced more than 20 million volumes. Now it's Wikipedia, so maybe the printing presses had produced that many volumes, maybe not. But I think that we can say there was a kind of social media in this time period. Maybe we could call it the first incarnation of social media. I say this because the ideas of the radical thinkers of the time, like Servetus and Biandrata and Francis David, these ideas spread hundreds and thousands of miles from place to place. How? Well, one way was through word of mouth, which of course is not as fast as our electronic version of spreading news and ideas, but maybe it's just as factual. Here's an example. The ideas of Michael Servetus were spread by word of mouth. The fact that he died a horrible death was also noticed at the time by witnesses and then discussed and spread throughout what we now call Europe by people telling Servetus' story. And there were several high-ranking people, nobles, who said, "Where is it written that we can burn somebody at the stake for the way they think?" And I have to say this caveat that I've said before when I've talked about this time period. The peasants and the people we call serfs weren't out there running around, you know, objecting to burning at the stake. They were really busy trying to live from day to day. So this would be the upper class. Servetus happened to be in Italy when the Pope was crowning Charles V as Roman Emperor. Servetus was disgusted by the ceremony, and he wrote these words: "With these very eyes I saw him," the Pope, "borne with pomp on the shoulders of princes, and in the public streets adored by the whole people, kneeling. Oh, beast of beasts, the most wicked, most shameless of harlots." And there you have Servetus's opinion of the papacy and the corrupt Catholic Church. So Servetus' story spreads from Spain to Italy to Germany and finally to Transylvania, thanks to Biandrata, the court physician in Poland, who, interestingly enough, no, there won't be a quiz, especially not in these little trivia things, but Biandrata was, quote, an expert in women's diseases. Not sure what that meant in the mid-1500s, but he wrote about these a lot. And the royal family in Poland was connected by blood to the royal family in Hungary and Transylvania. So Biandrata went to Transylvania and to be the court physician to Isabella, the mother of our only Unitarian king, Sigismund. I'll tell you another story about, unfortunately, how the ideas of people were spread, not just because of their ideas and their life, but because of the horrible deaths they lived. This is the story of Catherine Vogel, sometimes called Viga, who lived in Krakow, Poland. Sometime during the 1520s, someone reported her to a bishop claiming that she was a heretic. She didn't try to hide anything when she was asked about this by the bishop. She said that she did not believe in the Trinity, only in the unity of God, just like Jesus. And that was a quote. We do have some of her quotes passed down in writing. Well, at this point, the bishop locked her up in the chapel of the main church in Krakow. But as soon as she recanted, he said he would give her back her freedom. This continued for 10 years. On April 19th, 1539, she was taken to the town square. She was by now 80 years old. And according to witnesses, which, boy, that would have been really old for the 1520s, she went boldly and cheerfully to the square, probably knowing what her fate was going to be, saying that neither, and this is a direct, supposedly direct quote of Catherine's, neither in this life nor the next can anything evil befall the soul of one who stands loyal to the truth as one is given to know it. Then, like Servetus and many others, she was burned at the stake. Another interesting tidbit, when Servetus was burned at the stake, all the accounts say that unseasoned logs were used. I'm not sure what that means, except I suspect they would take longer to burn. So I tell you their stories, Servetus's and Vigel's, to help you better imagine that time period, because in our imaginings we're all in the nobility, so we all have the luxury of thinking about these things and writing about them and talking about them and discussing them. I'm hoping that knowing some of the stories here will help you better understand how what a period of turmoil this was, and how lucky we are that we are here now. And nobody, I don't think anyone is going to burn us at the stake for our beliefs. I need to repeat the definition of religion here that I think best suits Unitarian Universalism. And this comes from Unitarian Universalist minister Forest Church. It's very brief, and maybe you could all memorize it. So when people say, you go to a church, talk about religion. Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. Don't be afraid of that word. Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. Servetus, I ran across when I was doing the research for this morning, and ran across kind of a definition of religion by Servetus. Now remember, Servetus came of age right when the reformers are, they're the reformers. Lutheran, somebody said? Yes, the Lutherans, the Calvinists, and we call them the Presbyterians, and then eventually the Unitarians, and many others. I mean, there'll be so many people coming out of this tumultuous, but I think probably very exciting time in the mid to late 1500s. Servetus said that an abstract doctrinal belief such as the Trinity was the wrong test for authentic religion. Some of you may know about Servetus's life, and if not his death. Have any of you heard of Michael Servetus? But have any of you heard of, well, you'd be amazed how many people, even in Unitarian Universalists, groups have not. But how many of you know anything about why we know about him? He was a lawyer, he was a cartographer, he was a theologian, but he was something else, and that's how most people know about him. He was a physician. He discovered I didn't understand this when I looked it up, but something about how the blood moves through the body, pulmonary circulation, he's responsible for this. And the fact that the blood moves from the right chamber of the heart to the lungs and doesn't go somewhere else or something. But that's why a lot of people know about Servetus. What a person he was. We don't know much about many other martyrs to religious freedom. For example, did you know that 30,000 people were killed for their religious beliefs in Holland and Friesland, which was a province of what we now call the Netherlands? 30,000 people were martyred between 1535 and 1546. That's like 11 years. Because they were, this is a quote, left-wing Protestants. Free thinkers, these folks were. And many of those who were not put to death managed to flee, forced to flee, really, to save their lives. The good news is that they took their so-called left-wing beliefs with them and helped spread the good news about what it means to be a left-wing Protestant, I guess, throughout Europe, first into northern Italy, then to Poland, eventually into Hungary and Transylvania, eventually to England, eventually here. One of the persons caught up in this dispersion across northern Italy and into eastern Europe was Menno, M-E-N-N-O is his first name, Simons, and we call his followers Mennonites. This was the Radical Reformation. These people were the radical reformers who, among other things, rejected infant baptism. They didn't have any trouble with adult baptism if the adult wanted it. No infant baptism. We don't probably maybe care about that much, but here's something else they insisted upon. Separation of church and state. It's the mid-1500s. And maybe most importantly, right there with separation of church and state, personal religious experience, personal convictions were of the highest importance when arguing about beliefs or anything theological. What you have to try to understand is that these debates and discussions about these sorts of things that maybe we don't care a whole lot about now, except obviously some of them we still do, these were as important to them as our political debates. These were rough and tumble discussions, and I'll get back to that in just a minute. But I hope you're beginning to get a sense of how important this gift is. Can you understand more fully how we became an ethical religion as opposed to a creedal religion? Can you begin to see the thread that ties us to those radical reformers? Can you grasp how amazing it is that we can sing a song such as our opening song, our Bond of Union song, and no one is going to be arrested, I promise you, at least not this morning, or taken to court for expressing the radical ideas in that song? And those, you just take a good look at that song again. I agree. We've got a future protester in there. You look at those words. People are still being killed all over the world for saying that God is love or the unity of God or there is no God. This is still very important stuff. And stuff is such an intellectual word. How this becoming an ethical religion has affected our current thoughts about social justice. I just mentioned the Mennonites. There were people back in the 1500s who read that New Testament and interpreted it as saying clearly that Christians should not enter into military service or politics. Well, that's the Jehovah's Witnesses, I believe, right, who believe that. And there are other groups that believe that too. But then there were other Christians of the time in the 1500s who decided because Jesus preached that all are equal, then communal property was logical, as were communal marriages. Some talked about the impending end of the world and therefore the need to abandon worldly responsibilities. We can trace our wonderful gift of free religious thought directly back to the beginnings of Unitarianism in Transylvania. Now, back to those book club members. The doctor, Biandrata. The preacher, Francis David. The lawyer and the scientist, Michael Servetus, and the king, John Sigismund. I like to put a different spin on that and say a doctor, a king, a preacher, and a lawyer go into a bar. No, they did better than that. They went into history, the broad history of the Radical Reformation, but the more specific history of Unitarianism. Now, just for a moment, and then I'll let you tell me why some people are brave enough to speak up and others aren't. There would be edicts, or there would be the king would, or queen, because Queen Isabella, John Sigismund's mother, was the, I believe it's called regent. The king, Sigismund's father, died when John was 2 months old, I think. So Isabella was actually responsible. We should remember that for the first two edicts of religious freedom. So how do you get the word out to the common folk that now we believe da-da-da? We used to believe this, but now we believe this. So, and it's the law of the land now. How to tell them? Well, they did this. Here we are with social media again. Flyers, what we would call flyers. Brochures. There were brochures from that time. Books. Lots of books arguing your case. But mainly, these ideas were spread and expressed in debates. These debates weren't exactly the same as what we think now. The one that resulted in the Edict of Torda, the big one, went on for 10 days. They began at 5 in the morning, and it was up to the king to decide who had won, so to speak. So when we got to this third one, I'm going to read it to you. It's very, very brief. King John Sigismund finally decided that, yes, the unity of God, or love, if you prefer that word, was what was important. Forget this Trinity stuff. We didn't need to argue over that and talk about that. Some of you know that I went to Transylvania 2 years ago. So I got to see all these places. I got to see where these debates took place. Francis David, remember, is the court preacher. And he, of course, heavily influenced King John Sigismund, as did Biandrata. So Francis David wins this big debate, which said, no, there's no Trinity. And we don't believe in predestination either, by the way. And we don't believe in infant baptism and all these other things that I said to you and earlier. And I don't know if this is urban myth or not, but I love this story. So he went back to Kolozsvár, which was then the biggest city in Transylvania, and the streets were lined, or the lanes were lined with people supporting him and cheering him and everything, and he got to the outskirts of Kolozsvár, and there was a huge boulder there, and he stood up on it, and this is our Unitarian shrine, this boulder. It's still there. I saw it. I touched it. I don't think you were supposed to touch it. But anyway, he was, everyone was so excited that the urban myth, if it is such a thing, has it, that right then and there, when Francis David was standing on the boulder, everyone in the town converted to Unitarianism. This is also known as the Golden Age of Unitarianism. The Edict of Torda, and then I will end my remarks. Now, it's heavily laden with God language, of course, but that's all right. You can get the gist of it. His Majesty, our Lord. Now, in this case, our Lord is the king. It's King Sigismund. So, His Majesty our Lord, in what manner he, together with his realm, legislated in the matter of religion at the previous diets. This, the word diet is capital D. It's not our kind of diet. A diet means a parliament or a meeting or gathering. So the king legislated in the matter of religion at the previous diet, in the same manner now in this diet, which would have been that third diet of Torda. The diet is the meeting, and then it's followed by where it was held. So in this case, Torda. Reaffirms that in every place the preachers shall preach and explain the gospel, each according to his understanding of it. And if the congregation like it, well, if not, no one shall compel them, for their souls would not be satisfied, but they shall be permitted to keep a preacher whose teaching they approve. Therefore, none of the superintendents or others, like bishops, shall abuse the preachers. No one shall be reviled for his religion by anyone, according to the previous statutes, and it is not permitted that anyone should threaten anyone else by imprisonment or by removal from his post for his teaching. This is huge, because all that stuff was happening regularly, where the superintendents of the district would not permit preachers to go and do pastoral care in the homes of people in the congregation. So this is now illegal. And the last line in this Edict of Torah is, for faith is the gift of God, and this comes from hearing, and which hearing is by the word of God, which has been interpreted to mean, and I think it's you. It's your inner voice. It's not what anybody like me standing up there or Pope or whatever. Now, of course, there were some flaws in the Edict of Torda. It didn't really acknowledge the individual's right to religious freedom, but it emphasized the local community's right to choose their pastors. It didn't cover certain groups like Orthodox Romanians or Jews or Muslims. But the Edict of Torda was an extraordinary achievement of religious tolerance by the standards of 16th century Europe. It was the first law to officially sanction the existence of a radical Christian community. These folks were considered to be radicals. I ask you again then, why do some people have the courage, whatever it is, whatever word you want to put in there, to be radicals, to go back and speak again and again with authenticity and integrity from the deepest parts of their being, from their souls. Even though this speaking truth to power could result in their losing everything, or, as someone in this congregation knows, could result in you being escorted out of the Capitol by the police. Good for you. I was wondering if we were going to have to come and make bail. Why do some people do this, and then the majority of people say nothing? Or is that unkind of me to say the majority of people? So, closing words are by Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their visions, we too dream. May it be so. Go in peace, greet your neighbor, eat Kringle at least. Yeah.